Live from the Carter Subaru Studio, this is the Jason Rance Show. If you want to join the conversation, go online, mynorthwest.com. Click on that Linwood Honda inbox. Search for the name Jason Rance. We love getting your emails, even the incredibly cynical ones about politics. We like those. MyNorthwest.com. So apparently there is some controversy brewing over training King County deputies on the proper use of a neck restraint against certain suspects when appropriate, when the need arises. This would, of course, be an alternative to using a taser, to using a baton, obviously an alternative to using a gun if you don't need to use one for defense. This tactic has been on a 10-year hiatus, and it's unclear why they stopped, but it is coming back. It's called, this is what it's called, lateral vascular neck restraint, LVNR. Basically, it's a chokehold. Put all the semantic nonsense aside, it's a chokehold. And the Seattle Times says it involves applying pressure to the sides of the neck, restricting blood flow to the brain. The restraint can render a suspect unconscious in moments without inflicting permanent injury, according to sheriff's officials. Now, the controversy is over how safe this actually is. You've got folks on both sides of the issue. The trainers at the State Police Academy, according to the Times, as well as an instructor for the King County Sheriff's Office, believe this chokehold poses no more of a threat of permanent injury than other methods of force considered non-lethal, like the taser or a baton or pepper spray, if used the way it's supposed to be used. Because obviously, if you hit someone over the head repeatedly with a baton, you can risk some sort of permanent damage. But if you're using it the way you're supposed to, just to get someone to be less aggressive towards you, to neutralize them, it is, according to them, reasonably safe. Now, it is considered a blood choke. That, according to the Times, although officials at the Washington Criminal Justice Training Commission stress it is not a chokehold because the airway is not cut off to the arms or hands, blah, blah, blah. It's a chokehold. I don't know why they can't just say it is a chokehold. The bottom line is it restricts blood flow to and from the brain, resulting in unconsciousness, according to Robert Bragg, head fitness trainer at the State Police Academy. If it's done properly, Bragg said, a suspect will pass out within seconds, giving officers a brief window to clamp on handcuffs. Now, trainers at the academy say a vascular hold tends to be more of a deterrent. Often when an officer wraps his arm around a suspect's neck and threatens to apply pressure, the person actually gives up. Now, others argue that it's actually dangerous, according to the Times. They write, quote, neck restraints, when improperly applied, can have debilitating, even deadly results. They cite the recent death critics of a man being restrained by NYPD officers, an incident caught on a widely viewed video, as evidence of the volatility of targeting the neck to gain compliance. Now, because of that potential danger, Seattle Police and Washington State Patrol consider any neck restraint a type of lethal force, similar to the use of a firearm. Officers with those agencies aren't trained in neck restraints, and their use is limited to only when an officer believes his or her life is in danger. Now, here's the thing. Everything has downsides, right? Every single potential use of force has a downside, has a consequence, a potential consequence. You taser someone with a heart condition, that heart condition could become aggravated and that person could die. You hit someone with a baton at the right moment, the right angle, you might knock them out and kill them. Hell, you could cuff someone and maybe their brittle wrists will get little fractures in them. There's always a downside to something. There's always the potential for something unintended to happen. But here's the thing. There is a surefire way to make sure no one gets hurt when they're dealing with officers. Very, very simple thing. Don't break the law in the first place. Don't force a cop into having to do anything to you. That's something that is very easy to do. I understand there are some complexities to that because, sure, stuff happens. Sometimes officers are going to talk to you. Sometimes you make a mistake in speed. Sometimes even you maybe mouth off. That's sort of your instinctual reaction, your instinctive reaction. And maybe you find yourself handcuffed. But here's the thing. A cop's not just going to put you in a chokehold for the hell of it. They're not just going to taser you because they want to. They're not going to hit you with a baton because they're bored. That's only something that happens when provoked, almost a last resort, a way to neutralize the suspect. Now, in the case of a chokehold, regardless of some of the consequences, regardless of some of the folks who are really concerned about the safety use when used improperly, yeah, anything used improperly can cause damage. But I'm all for another tactic. I think we should have another tactic. Anything to prevent a gun from being used. Shouldn't you be in favor of that? So look forward to this being trained. Look forward to it being taught to people. The training should go on. People should use this appropriately and hopefully effectively, and then we can look at some of the results. But I'd love to hear from you. MyNorthWest.com. Click on that Linwood Honda inbox, search for the name Jason Rantz. Of course, you can also go to Facebook.com/Jason Rantz. The next story we're about to do in 4 minutes gives me such mixed feelings. I'm both happy that I can tell you this, but I'm also really disgusted. 4 minutes on the Jason Rantz Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show. With mixed feelings, I bring you this next story from Gaza that shows you just how callous the terrorist organization Hamas is and will always be. But part of me is glad it was caught on tape because it's going to help let folks truly understand what Israel is dealing with. New Delhi Television, NDTV, reported this morning that in the minutes before the ceasefire kicked in at Gaza this morning, Hamas fired a flurry of rockets towards Israel. According to some counts, 30. So right before the ceasefire, Hamas sends over 30 rockets. Now, as you know, Israel has basically argued that these rockets are being fired from really densely populated civilian areas. And this is exactly why the retaliatory strikes result in civilian casualties. Even though Israel goes out of their way to tell these folks to leave, we are about to hit this particular target. Please leave if you are innocent. Get away. Which strategically is very dumb if you're going after Hamas, because you're basically telling Hamas at the exact same time you should leave too. But that's the type of war that Israel wants to fight, a morally just war. Now, this morning, NDTV witnessed a rocket silo being created under a tent right next to a hotel where their reporting team was staying. Minutes later, they saw rockets being fired just before the 72-hour ceasefire came into effect. Here is Sri Vansan Jain reporting from his hotel room.
Okay, so we're witnessing something very, very unusual in this plot of land. Abandoned plot of land right next to our hotel. A blue tent has come up. It wasn't there last night. It came up just this morning, and there have been two men moving in and out of it. Now, by reasonable doubt, it's fair to guess that this is a potential Hamas rocket launching site that's being set up. There's always been this question of how Hamas manages to fire its rockets without being detected by the Israelis. This perhaps is one of the ways of assembling it under a tent. It also establishes something which Hamas has always been accused of, that they actually use densely populated civilian areas to fire their rockets. And if the camera zooms out a little more, you'll see that this is an area very heavily built up, a lot of residential and hotel buildings all around. And so if Hamas does fire a rocket from here, it will have immediate consequences for everyone around here.
And this was the exact site that had a rocket launched from it earlier in the week. And now you could reasonably say, hey, this doesn't prove anything, right? I mean, there's just some tent being set up. It doesn't prove that this is actually a Hamas site for a rocket launch, but things get awfully suspicious.
It now remains to be seen whether if this is indeed a Hamas rocket launch site, that they're going to use it to detonate it remotely. We can see one of the men leaving. He's got something on his head. He just looks like he's coming out either onto the road or he's gone behind the tree there. The other guy is standing behind the tree. Again, as I said, this is a very, very unusual sight to actually witness in Gaza, the possibility that we're seeing Hamas setting up for a rocket launch just meters away from our hotel, and again, as I point out, bang in the middle of what is a residential area full of hotels. and apartment buildings.
So clearly awfully suspicious. Guess what happened later?
So that's the rocket being fired today morning, a day after it was assembled at the exact spot the rocket has been fired. That's the smoke. We just shot a video of it in the immediate aftermath.
Does that give context to some folks? Because it should. You've got a lot of people who are saying that Israel is targeting civilians. But this is where Hamas is firing their rockets. They're going next to hotels. They're going right next to hospitals. They're going next to schools and apartment buildings and mosques. This is where they're firing their rockets. Now, if you're of the opinion, well, too bad, Israel, you still can't do anything back because you might kill some civilians, I would argue they're not killing civilians. Civilians are dying. It is true. But they're dying because of Hamas. They're dying because of where Hamas chooses to fire their rockets that are there to target specifically Israeli civilians. And yet we've got folks like Shama Sawant who are trying to use the Seattle City Council to push a truly anti-Semitic viewpoint, which is Israel is to blame. This is all on Israel. This is all on them. They're targeting civilians. That's what we're hearing. That's what Hamas is saying. There are people who are basically taking the exact same standpoint that Hamas is taking in the context of whether or not Israel has a right to defend itself. Would we have that conversation about the United States if all of a sudden Canada decided, even if it was some little rocket, and they started to hit or try to hit Blaine, Washington, right at the border? What would the response be of you? What would you respond with? You would say, I don't care that this was a little rocket. We're going after whomever fired it. Because we actually give a damn about the residents of Washington State, the residents of the United States. Because that little rocket could have killed an American citizen, an innocent American citizen. And what if it did kill someone? What if it did kill one person in Blaine? Canada would pay. They would pay militarily. That's what countries do. They defend themselves. Now consider this. Consider the context of what Israel has to go through and what Israel has consistently gone through, which was a daily fight for their actual survival. They are surrounded by enemies. Their partnership right now with Egypt is tenuous at best. Remember, Egypt tried to also destroy Israel. They're constantly surrounded by people who don't think they have the right to exist. They're viewed as bloodthirsty rats. That's how people view Israel. That's how their enemies view Israel and Jews and Israelis. That's the context in which they struggle to survive. And they're to blame for deciding, you know what, enough is enough. We have to go after these rockets. We have to go after these sites for tunnels that are being dug for the only reason to kill and kidnap Jews. That's why they have those tunnels there. Hamas doesn't even say otherwise. And yet you've got people who are basically saying, well, this is all on Israel. No, I'm sorry, it's not on Israel. It's on the terrorist organization. The terrorist organization that was voted into power and then kept power by kicking out all of the dissenting opinion. And Israel is at fault. I'd love to hear from you. MyNorthwest.com. Click on the Linwood Honda inbox. Search for the name Jason Rentz. When we come back, a member of the Seattle Privacy Coalition joins us to talk about some concerns they're having with some policies, some programs, some equipment that's being installed by the Seattle PD. But I'm also going to ask why someone who is so concerned about privacy wears a Google Glass around. It's the Jason Rantz Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show. More than a year after Seattle police promised to not turn on a network of surveillance cameras and communication nodes installed as part of a federal post-security grant, the Seattle Times says they still haven't offered a policy on how they'll use the equipment to ensure citizen privacy. One activist, Lee Colleton from the Seattle Privacy Coalition, told the Times that he's got some concerns. So what exactly are the concerns? Well, let's ask him. Lee Colleton joins me on the line now. Lee, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Oh, of course. My pleasure.
So a Homeland Security grant has mostly been spent so far on surveillance cameras, on drones, on communication nodes. Now, I understand that you have some privacy concerns, which we'll address in a second, but I wanted to sort of get a baseline from you as far as whether or not you object to the use of the technology just in general.
Well, so I'm calling you from a cell phone right now, which has a wireless radio in it and a Bluetooth radio, and I don't fundamentally object to this sort of technology. I would, on the contrary, I would rather that we have devices just like this blanketing the city in internet access, which the city could do. I mean, in some places, like in Mountain View, California, they have a municipal wireless network throughout the entire city. You can go anywhere and have free access to the internet. So the system that the police are setting up will be a free access mesh network that's only for them and for city employees. But so far, it's not being opened up to the public. The police haven't even used it themselves because they haven't been able to write this privacy policy.
Mm-hmm. The basic use of the technology, even just for police official use, which I understand, like conceptually I understand why they would want to use it. Are you okay with that so long as there are some privacy sort of policies in place?
Yes. I want the police to be able to do their job. And it's only when they use technologies that have the potential to infringe on our right to privacy that I become concerned. This Seattle Privacy Coalition got its start both when these cameras and mesh networks were installed on Alki and through the downtown, but also at about the same time, the Seattle police had acquired a pair of drones that they intended to fly over the city. Now, the drones that they had were a very limited use, but it sets a precedent where if they have these devices then and they have permission to use them, then when the next round of drones come out, maybe they can stay in the air for an hour instead of 10 minutes, or maybe they can stay in the air all day or continuously. And if they already have their foot in the door with the permission, either explicit or implicit, to use these things, then it becomes harder to have that conversation about, you know, do we want to have this particular type of surveillance technology in use? And that's why the Seattle Privacy Coalition has pushed for an ordinance. We have one on the books. It's Ordinance 124142, and it has provisions now for the acquisition of surveillance technology, where the police can't just go and buy, you know, we've seen drones and cameras. I don't know what the next thing would be, but some new surveillance technology that comes around, they would have to go to the city council first and explain what they were going to do with it, write up a privacy policy and a data retention policy, and, you know, justify this.
Would you want them, let me just jump in real quickly. So when they would come up, presumably, to the city council to say, hey, we want to use technology X for, you know, whatever particular reason they had, are you arguing that the city council then would have to give permission? Or would you simply say this is more of a, let's get it on the record so we know what you actually want to use this for, and then we can keep you accountable to using it for the originally stated purpose?
It's exactly that they would have to justify what they intended to do with it and also have the permission of the city council. I mean, currently, the Seattle police, and we keep picking on them because they're sort of leading the charge on the deployment of these new surveillance technologies, but that ordinance does apply to every city department and agency. But so let's say the Seattle police, you know, they have license plate recognition systems that can automatically record the license plates of cars and show if a car is stolen or if it's on a hot list for some reason. Well, let's say that they want to upgrade that system and have it record every single person's face as their cars drive down the streets and put those all into a database. They would then have a record of where every person was and who they were standing next to. Now, that's the sort of thing that most people would pause and say, that seems like an overreach. That seems like something the police should not be able to do.
Do you think people would actually pause at that? Because I've struggled a little bit with with that exact sort of question. When I look at what we've learned post Edward Snowden, and there really hasn't been this sort of uprising from the average person. There have absolutely been some interests, certainly from privacy activists. But I look at the average person, I get the sense that they see something like that. And to use your example, I think they might say, okay, so they've got a picture of my face, Jason Rantz, walking down the street, and they've got it put in some sort of collection bin somewhere in the ether. Do I personally care? Because I know, for example, I'm not a criminal. I am not a terrorist. I'm not, you know, X, Y, and Z, and they'll never actually have any sort of use for that particular image of me. So tell me why that thinking is incorrect, why we shouldn't go down that route.
So that is the prevalent response. It's one that I often hear from people when I talk about these issues. It's essentially the "I have nothing to hide" argument. And this is a concern because we aren't the ones who get to decide whether we have anything to hide or not. If you happen to have your picture taken next to someone who turns out to be a terrorist or a criminal or, you know, someone who becomes a person of interest, and all of this information is stored and indexed, and the metadata of, you know, who was walking down the street next to this person is available, then there's this guilt by association that is implicit in that. You know, the person who's looking at this data can say, oh, well, it looks like you got onto a train with this person, mm-hmm. and, you know, traveled to the next city and got off at the exact same stop. I wonder why that is. And that could be used as a justification to, you know, to get a warrant or a subpoena for records about you. And this is the problem, is that everyone has something to hide, even if it's the most banal sorts of things. Like, we all have curtains on our windows, and, well, most of us wear clothes. And those are just basic examples. But if someone truly has nothing to hide, then I would invite them to meet the challenge that Glenn Greenwald puts to every person who asks him this question, which is, if you have nothing to hide, please send me your email address and your password, and I'd like to look through all of your email and publish whatever I find interesting there. Because if you don't have anything to hide, then it's okay to publicize any detail of your life. And this is the same problem that the police face. They're given this task of finding criminals and apprehending them and keeping us safe. And if they had a total awareness of everything that happened in the city, then it would be easier for them to do their job. However, it would also infringe on our constitutional rights to privacy and freedom of association, and even freedom of speech. Because if you know that what you're saying is being recorded by the state, then it affects what you say. You will self-censor yourself, So it has a chilling effect when people are under surveillance.
I'm talking with Lee Collodin of the Seattle Privacy Coalition. We're going to be back in 4 minutes. We're going to continue this discussion on The Jason Rantz Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rantz Show. I'm joined by Lee Collodin of the Seattle Privacy Coalition, and we're talking about a front page story on the Times this morning about some privacy activists' concern to the use of some surveillance equipment by the Seattle PD, and just the general sense of whether or not you should feel like you have this sort of right to privacy when you're out in public. And that seems to be what this is really about, Lee. Do you think that if you're out on the street, if you're walking down in Capitol Hill or in Everett or in Tacoma, should you feel like you have this sort of right to not be recorded?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that when the founders of this country, the people who are writing up our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, if they had been able to peer into the future and seen the sort of surveillance and recording technologies that would be coming, they would have absolutely written in a right to privacy in the Bill of Rights. they didn't, because at the time, if you wanted to have a private conversation with someone, you would walk out into a field and converse, and then whatever was said would be hearsay if someone were to repeat it. You know, that's the sort of thing that we have lost. And at the same time, you know, I'm not opposed to technology. It has wonderful benefits, sure, but we have to codify the way that it can be used in our society.
Otherwise, it sounds to our detriment. Sure, and it sounds like it's more about the potential for abuse sort of being the biggest reason for you having your concerns and wanting the regulation or some sort of rules. Not necessarily that you think it will be abused, but it could be abused.
Well, what we know about these surveillance systems is that they are abused. Whenever you create a store of data like this, and it happens at many different levels. I mean, the NSA has a term for it. They call it, well, one type of this abuse is love int, or intelligence activities that these analysts and spies will do based on their own love interests, where they'll find the phone number of their girlfriend or someone they're interested in and see who this person is calling, right? Mm-hmm. And those things can be picked up, but only if we have auditing systems in place and policies and procedures that govern the way that this information is accessed and used. And it's the sort of data that, you know, if someone's walking down the street in this country, you can see their picture, and there's no rule against that. In Washington State, you have to inform them if you're going to make an audio recording. But for video and for photographs, you generally don't have to have their permission.
Yeah, and I think that's incredibly troubling. And it's funny you bring that up, because there was something that in the story in the Times today that was just sort of a glaring irony, I thought, was there was a photo of you, and in that photo, you were wearing Google Glass, or what looked like you were wearing a pair of Google glasses. That has been at the center of a lot of controversy having to do with privacy rights, specifically people feeling like they may be videotaped or photographed unknowingly, whether they're walking down the street or maybe they're at a bar or a club of some sort, by someone wearing Google Glass. And so I'm wondering how you can sort of justify your concern that I think is reasonable as it relates to the privacy rights of people, and the fact that you also wear something, a piece of technology that can easily be abused.
Yes, this is something that I've thought a lot about. And I previously worked for Google, but I'm currently not an employee of theirs. So I can make some very direct comments that Google Glass has two design flaws that were identified, but they went ahead and shipped it anyway. The biggest flaw, the thing most people notice, is that it doesn't have a cover over the lens. It doesn't have a lens cap or a sliding lens cover or any kind of mechanism of covering the lens. And so there's that question that people have when they see it. Am I being recorded? Am I being photographed? And it puts people on edge. It makes them tense. And I think that's a flaw. Usually I will cover over the lens with a sticker or a post-it note or a 3D printed lens cover that sort of slides over the device. So that's something that's not as easily fixable with this version. But the other problem, which I think is actually a bigger problem with Google Glass that most people aren't aware of, is that it will automatically upload every photo and video to Google servers. That's the way it's designed to work. And it doesn't share those photos with anyone by default, only Google. And that's fine if you trust Google, but every photo and video that's uploaded is analyzed and processed. It's passed through facial recognition filters.
But aren't you forcing sort of passersby, so people who are around you, to accept the fact that maybe you trust Google when they might not?
Exactly. So
why do you wear the Google Glass, I guess, is what I'm saying. It almost seems hypocritical to be, not hypocritical, but it certainly seems a little ironic, I suppose, that you're telling everyone to be really, really hypervigilant about some of the technology that's out there and how it can be abused, but at the very same time, you're wearing a piece of technology that could also be abused.
Yes, and there's two There's two aspects of that. One is, if I were given the choice of everyone being given a free Google Glass or a device like it that they could wear and use to record everything that they saw, or that we would have cameras on every street corner and suspended above every city that photographed and recorded every single thing that happened and uploaded all of that to either the state or to a company that could be compelled to disclose it, I would absolutely choose the former and not the latter, because that puts the onus on individuals. And it's an example that is very close to the truth, because with camera phones being as cheap as they are, they're practically given away by the carriers to people. Mm-hmm. And this technology of being able to surreptitiously record someone, I think, is cast into stark relief by a device like Google Glass, but it's not anything new. We've had pinhole cameras for decades now, even before digital film, that would allow people to make surreptitious photographs.
And sure, but the difference is, I suppose, is you can take the photograph of someone or a video, for example, simply by looking in their general direction. Whereas otherwise, if you don't have that kind of device like a Google Glass, you'd have to take out the phone and it wouldn't be so subtle. You would actually have to point that phone towards someone, and it's a little bit different. So I think that's where the concern is.
Yes. And that's why I said that Google Glass has a hardware flaw, that it doesn't have a lens cover. Because if there was a lens cover and it's some action, you know, you had to pull up your hand and move the lens to the side to actually take a picture, then it would be obvious what you were doing.
Yes. Well, I've got about a minute left, so I want to just wrap up this brief conversation, because I find this particular aspect of it especially interesting given some of your views on privacy. You would readily admit that it's certainly possible for governmental officials, law enforcement officials, to abuse the type of technology that allows them to pretty much spy on people without their knowledge. Do you also admit that you, Lee Colleton of the Seattle Privacy Coalition, are also susceptible to that potential type of abuse of trust and privacy due to the Google Glass that you wear?
Yes, and the difference would be I am not the state. I do not have a badge and the ability to use lethal force in the application of the law. I'm a private individual. And so I don't think that people should be stripped of their rights to record things. I think quite the contrary, that, you know, we've seen, you know, from Rodney King up through the modern day, you know, the situations in Oakland and elsewhere, where people with camera phones and video cameras are able to hold the public and the public officials and the police to account for their abuses of power and authority. So I would rather see surveillance than surveillance if we were to have, you know, one or the other.
Lee Colleton from the Seattle Privacy Coalition. If anyone wants to find out additional information on the Seattle Privacy Coalition, go to seattleprivacy.org. Lee, I appreciate you spending some time with us tonight.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Jason Rancho Coast to Coast is up next.